Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hey everyone, and welcome to All Together, the Family Science Insights podcast, produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm your host, Dina Sargent. Let's get started.
Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode. Now, family rituals are seen as special things that you and your family do together. Now, a lot of rituals are aimed to state, this is who we are, and this is what we stand for. This is what a lot of what we do. These rituals are seen as important in building a relationship as a family. Our guest today is here to talk about the role communication plays in creating these family rituals. She is a Willa Cather Professor of Interpersonal and Family Communication at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. A lot of her research looks into communication in understanding and changing families alongside communication rituals that take place. You can definitely see why she is our guest today, Dr. Dawn O'Braithwaite. Thank you so much for joining me, Dawn.
Oh, delighted to be here.
Now, a lot of your focus is in communication. What is your role in helping individuals understand different communication styles within a family?
One of the things I like to talk about is that we have what we would call a repertoire of communicative choices. You know, repertoire would be like if you were a baseball player in America, you have different pitches that you use. If you're a cook, you have different recipes you use. And so one of my goals is to help people have a broader selection of, if you think about it this way, communication recipes, different ways they can approach different people in different situations so that family communication is never one size fits all.
Well, that's perfect. I think communication is a huge thing to me because it envelops so much. And a lot of what we do is communicate, whether it's verbal or nonverbal. It can be so much as body language within communication, and body language within a family is such a big thing because everyone is always heightened when it comes to how we understand body behavior, how we understand communication behavior. And honestly, I could be such a geek in this episode today because this is one area that I'm really interested in understanding. And especially when it comes to a family, everyone has a different way, a different style in itself that is so different to every other member of their family when it comes to how they express themselves, whether it's by verbal communication or body communication. So I can't wait to get deeper into this topic today.
Absolutely. It's complicated. And when we think about families, we're thinking about both the individuals, but also the larger family system. It could be the family system within one household. It could be the large extended family system. And so it does get complicated. It's never easy. And families, like everything else, are always changing.
Now, for a lot of people that don't know or don't know a lot about communication, what's a fun fact that you would like to share with us about it today?
Well, my part of the communication field broke away from English. So we were, before my time, a little bit over 100 years ago, were in English departments, and they were thinking that if you gave a speech, it was an essay on its feet. And they didn't see any difference between verbal or oral communication and written communication. In fact, they really refused to see it. So in 1913, 17 people walked out of the National Council on Teachers of English, I think it was, when they were meeting in Chicago, which is my hometown, and started their own association to study communication. And we're more interested in the, oral and verbal message-based communication. That includes nonverbal communication as well, but all non-written communication, if you think about it that way.
Wow. No, that's a really great fact because you always see it as all-encompassing one thing. You don't really see it as being written as seen as one thing and verbal seen as another thing. And it's really interesting to know that there was a huge conflict within that huge conflict as to how some people saw written communication as being the only way, the one way that you can go, completely negating the fact that, the way that they're arguing is verbal communication.
Yeah. I mean, they knew it was there, but they just didn't think it was anything different. And okay. We know, you know, and you make choices, I'm sure, all the time, whether you want to write something for somebody or whether you want to call them up or tell them face to face. And the fact that that's true tells us that these are different kinds of communication, all very important, but that studying communication, verbal communication on its own was different and worth studying. And so that's what caused the big walkout.
Yeah, it's like text versus call. Which one would you rather receive? Would you rather receive a call? Would you rather receive a text?
Exactly. And you think about that as a person sending a message. Do I want to say, give them bad news? Well, and these days we have so many choices, right? So many ways we can give good news or bad news or any news. So we think about those things if we're smart, carefully.
Yes, exactly. Now, thank you so much for that introduction. And before we get deeper into it, I'd love to get to know some of your interests and maybe some recommendations of things that we didn't really get to hear. Now, to start off with, what is the most recent book that you've read?
Yeah, I'm a bit embarrassed to tell you that the last book I read is my own book called Family Communication, Cohesion and Change, only because I just sent it off to the publisher last Thursday. So we've been embroiled in reading it for months on end. It's actually was the very first family communication textbook. It was started in 1982. And I came on in the 9th edition and we just turned in the 11th. So I'm a little relieved and probably have some bags under my eyes. But the other book I read recently, and I'm probably just a little behind on my reading, was Michelle Obama's book, Becoming. And I found it to be a very inspirational and joyful book.
Yes. Well, it's exciting the fact that you're up to the 11th edition of the book.
Yeah.
At the moment. There's the fact that we're able to have editions and keep adding more and more research and more knowledge. Uh-huh. And adding onto a lot of other people's knowledge is such an important way of sort of sharing the fact that we've come so far. We've come 11 editions so far in communication and how we communicate. Uh-huh. So that's congratulations to you for that.
Thanks.
As well.
We're really happy about it.
And when it comes to Michelle Obama's book, I've started reading it as well. I've just found a copy, so I've just gone to read it. And she is an amazing character in herself. And she's come so far in a way that, especially in a way that's not really promoting, she's having to carve her own way rather than following the footsteps of someone else, because there is no one else just sort of in her exact position.
Yeah. And like me, grew up in Chicago. We were both born on the south side of Chicago. So I think I relate to her in that way, but she's a very courageous person as well.
She really is.
Yeah, both of them. But I do love her book.
Yes. Okay. I can't wait to keep going with it. I'm going through, and I'm interested. I don't want to rush it. That's the problem with me. I want to really sit there and enjoy every part of it. So I can't wait to complete it and hopefully let everyone know how great it is. Now, what is a movie that you would recommend to our viewers?
You know, this is so strange. But I love the Shakespeare movie by Kenneth Branagh with Emma Thompson called Much Ado About Nothing. And I'm not even a huge Shakespeare fan, but every time I travel, I watch this movie again. And then another movie, it's older, called The American President with Michael Douglas and Annette Bening. And I guess I love that movie because I wish that was the government we had right now. But it's just kind of a silly romantic comedy, but I absolutely adore it.
Yes, I can definitely agree with you with Much Ado About Nothing. I just finished watching it a couple of days ago again for the 100th time. It's one of those movies I can always fall back on.
Yep. I'm surprised. I was wondering if you would have even seen it, but I probably have seen it 60 or 70. I don't know. I'd love to watch it when I travel.
Yes, it's such a great way of sort of showing the different dynamic that relationships that sisters sort of play, the different ways that that one sister doesn't negate the other sister's emotions, and it all fits in really well. And I honestly love Emma Thompson, so I cannot
I love
really
her.
I love her acting so much.
I do
like
too.
There's something about her that you can never really get tired of watching.
Exactly. I think she's just the star. She's just, and Denzel Washington, and I mean, everybody in the film is wonderful.
Yeah.
And it's,
yeah.
But it's, I could probably recite parts of it. I just absolutely love it.
Yeah, same here. Now, when it comes to a podcast, do you have a podcast that really stands out to you that you would love to share with us?
You know, it's funny, because I've been working so much, I just retired in the last year. So I haven't gotten myself involved in many podcasts, but I do love the podcast by Paula Poundstone, who is an American humorist, and she's just absolutely hilarious. And it's, I think it's called Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. And so if you ever get a chance to pick it up and listen to it, it's just, she's just so witty and so funny. And so that's my podcast of choice.
Oh, perfect. Well, I'll definitely have to go and look at that, because that sounds really interesting. I love those light and airy podcasts, as well as the ones that are really academic written, but I also love the ones that just, you don't really have to sit down and pay attention, that you can do other stuff with and listen to it. Yeah. So that's such a great recommendation. I'm going to definitely have to look at that up now.
Oh, good. I think she's a national treasure. She's so funny.
Now, when it comes to role model, do you have, either in your professional or even personal life, do you have someone that you find yourself looking up to?
You know, I could take the whole podcast and tell you about all my incredible role models. I've been so blessed that way. One person I really admire is Dr. Jolene Kester. And she earned her PhD in communication like I did at the University of Minnesota, but about 6 or 7 years before I did. And her most recent job is she was the chancellor of the California State University system, which has 23 campuses. So she's an incredible woman. And she came back out of retirement to take over and run the system for over a year at a very difficult time. And I admire her courage, her intelligence. But yet she's a person who cares about her family and friends. So I've never had a birthday go by that she didn't remember or reach out to her, and she is so screamingly busy that she wouldn't reach back. And she's her service to our discipline, to the academy, to the people she knows. She inspires me very much, and I just absolutely adore Dr. Kester.
Wow, now that's such an amazing role model to have. I think that holds a lot of detriment, that you can not only look up to her in professionally, but also how she manages personal life as well, how she manages everything that she has going on and still manages to send birthday messages or be there for other people. I think that's such a great omen to her character as well.
It is. I wish you could meet her.
I definitely wish I could meet her too. It sounds like an amazing person. Now, I hope that you're all warmed up with all the questions, and that we've gone through all the light and easy breezy questions before we get down to the deeper ones.
Okay, we're going to start talking about rituals, I bet.
Yes, and I'm very excited for this. Now, I know that everyone has a very different definition as to what family is and the importance that family holds. Either your professional or personal life, what do you think your definition of family would be?
Well, you're just asking a person who just published a family book. So I'm going to read you our definition, because I think this definition is important because it's in our minds, it's comprehensive. So we think of a family as networks of people who share their lives over a long period of time, bound by ties of marriage, blood, law, or commitment, legal or otherwise, who consider themselves to be a family, and who share a significant history and anticipated future together, functioning as a family. Now, I can unpack that a little bit if you want me to, because I know there's a lot to it. Would you like me to do that?
Yes, please.
So one of the things to us that's important is temporality or time. You know, it's easy to say everything's a family. You know, go to work, oh, we're a family at work. And we use that word casually. But for us, a family is a set of relationships that we experience over time. They're bound by different kinds of ties. These could be biological ties. These could be legal ties like marriage. And they could be non-legal ties of people that are cohabiting as families, and even families today that I also study, voluntary or chosen families. So that it doesn't have to be a biological or legal relationship to be a family. The people have to consider themselves a family. So that's important. We might look from the outside and think they're a family, but if they don't see themselves as a family, we're not going to count them as a family. And they have this history, and they have an anticipated future that they believe that they are going to be in a relationship in the future. Now, this doesn't mean that there's never a family estrangement, which is another topic that some of my students and I have studied. But those are the things that make us a family. And really what binds all that together is communication. And I'll talk about that probably a little bit more as we go on. But I don't know if that's helpful, but that's how we define a family. And we mean that definition to be broad, and we mean it to be more inclusive than exclusive.
Mm-hmm. No, I love the extent that we've sort of changed the idea of family over time, that it's not just who you're related to. It's not yes. just who your blood ties with or who you're married to. There's that idea of, okay, you can choose, you can pick your own family, because there's a lot yes. of people that you consider family that you're not either blood tied to, or you're not extended family attached to them in any way, right. but there's still that idea of, they still hold that importance, that level of respect of being a family member than
exactly.
even your own family do.
Yeah, one of my doctoral students that I'm working with is studying women who were in the military, and how even after they're out of the military, they still consider one another family. And so we call them military voluntary kin. And those are really important family members for people. And we can find it could be a person with whom you were in a drug rehab. And some people, those relationships persist past that time when they're not in that rehab anymore, and they may still consider each other family. So family comes to us in all different kinds of forms.
Now, with that definition in mind, do you think that family still holds a place in, still holds an importance even in the way that society is sort of functioning as it has done sort of decades in the past?
I think family is a cornerstone of society. And it doesn't mean that family doesn't change in an individual family or how we culturally think about families. But yeah, they're still very important to us. I mean, you think about the people that you would probably write down on paper. You know, one of the things we have students do the first day of class in family communication is list who's in their family. And a lot of times they're rather conservative about that. They think of them, again, as blood relatives or legal relatives. And as the semester goes on, you know, we come back to that question at the end. I give them the piece of paper back where they wrote down their family. And they're sometimes it's just exactly the same. And sometimes they're surprised that their list grows a bit more. And so that's something we want them to think about. It's not that we're telling them that a family has to be broader or has to be larger, but we want them to really think about who they're putting in that, who are they writing down on that paper and who are they leaving out? And that's, for all of us in our lives, really complicated and important questions to answer.
Yeah, that must be a heavy question to answer at the beginning, the first day of class as well. It's sort of like, who do you consider family?
Yeah. Sometimes they write down pets, for example. I had a person one time put their car, their automobile, as family. It's like, okay. You know, and I'm not really here to judge, you know. So it's really interesting to see how people think about family, but it is one of the more profound questions that we could ask somebody.
Yeah, no, it's amazing to sort of see the difference in how everyone sort of views what a family is and what their definition of family would be as well, because that's a very personal question to sort of ask how they sort of see a family.
Yeah, and if we're too casual about it and we think everything, every group we're in is family, then family really isn't going to mean anything. So, you know, if you think about the definition of from our book that I read you, that's a pretty comprehensive definition. But but I also don't advise that people call everybody a family. I just think it loses its meaning. And then, you know, is a family somebody you think is going to be there in 10 years or 20 years? Or, you know, how are you going to make judgments when you would call on them and what you would expect from them?
Mm-hmm. No, that's very true. And we know that within a family, there's a lot of communication that's involved. And we spoke about this a little bit earlier. So what are the characteristics of an effective communication within a family?
Well, it's a huge question, isn't it?
You know? Yes.
And what I want to do is I really want to get us to think about what we mean by communication. If we think about communication as just sending and receiving messages, you know, be home by 10 o'clock, if that's your curfew, or make sure that you do the dishes, or don't fight with your sister, whatever those things are, the sending and receiving messages is a big part of what communication is. But if that's all it is, it really wouldn't be very important. And so we think about communication as how we co-construct families, really all of our relationships and ourselves. And so, you know, how I've never met you before today, but so the tiny extent that I know you, it comes from communication. I may have read some things about you. You know, we've been emailing back and forth to get ready for this day today. You have looked at, you know, some of my materials and my website. So the things that we know about each other, as we start to interact with people, we start to co-construct a relationship. We start to build together an understanding of who we are. So I understand who you are, or start to understand who you are. I also start to understand who we are, and I start to understand differently who I am. And so it makes communication very profound, because it makes, I use the word cornerstone of families or a cornerstone of society. Communication is the cornerstone of humanity. It's the most important thing, because it's how we create. And we don't create it by ourselves. We co-create in relationship, in communication with other people. So I love studying, as you probably can tell, I'm very passionate about studying communication, because I can't think of one thing that's more important, one thing that's more pervasive in all parts of our personal lives, our family lives, our community life, our civic life, our organizational life. It's all about communication. And it's not all pleasant. It doesn't always go well, and it's always changing. So that's how I think about communication. And then the trick is, you know, how do we come together and co-create a positive family, healthy relationships? How do I become healthier and have well-being for myself in this set of relationships that I have in my life that come together because of, you know, through communication? So it's been my life's work to try to understand these things and understand how we can be more effective. Communication is flexible, because, you know, I was talking about having this repertoire of communicative choices. There's not one right way to communicate. And you probably know, as you're getting older, you know, I thought about how, you know, as my parents were aging, and, you know, I remember my father would, I was 45 years old, and my father was asking me if I was going to wear my jacket. Like, gosh, Dad, I'm 45. And then later I was kind of thinking about him. I hope Dad remembers to wear a jacket. And so communication is always changing through time, because we're changing. And we're, you know, and so communication needs to be competent, needs to be flexible. It should be tailored to the person and the group and the family with whom we're relating. And it may just be, you know, it may be a certain day or a certain type of year or a certain ritual. We also alter the way that we understand communication. We're always navigating similarity and difference. You know, when do we come together around similarity, and when do we deal with difference? And difference isn't necessarily bad. It's part of what draws us to people sometimes, that they're different. And so, and then another part, I could go on, but I'll just cut one other part about communication, is really starting to think about what to say, when to say it, and when not to say it. You know, and so one of the things we study in our field is managing what we call privacy. There's a theory called communication privacy management, which is based around the fact that saying everything is not a good idea. We all kind of know this, but we don't always practice it. Sometimes we say too much, or we say something about another person that we shouldn't have said, or we're not really sure, and then we reveal something. And one of the things we know about communication, you can't take it back. People say, pretend I never said that. Well, I can't. It's not possible. And so communication is what we call irreversible and unrepeatable. So good communication, you know, is something we should take seriously because there's a lot to consider. If we got too worried about it, we'd be paralyzed. We'd never say anything. And we don't want to do that either. But I hope that gives you some idea of how I think about it. So this idea of co-constructing selves, relationships, and families is what communication does. So much more than just sending messages.
Yeah, no, I think it's such an important thing to sort of recognize in a family as well. Like about a year ago, my mom was living in the same house with me and my sister. And then she recently, in the last couple of months, she's recently moved into state. So she's moved states completely. So we've had to find our new way of like communicating from seeing her every day to having a weekly, to setting a schedule of, okay, this is our weekly phone call. This is the time that we're set to talk to each other, that we're going to catch up on things that we have experienced separately or have gained the different events that we've had separately. And it's such an interesting change in our dynamic now as well, because it's, we've gone from telling each other immediately when something has happened to saving it all up for that one phone call where we can have a whole list of things that have happened. And it's definitely both ways with her as well, with a lot of stuff that she's building, the career that she's building there, where she is currently, and her having to save up all of those little ventures that she's done up for that one day. Mm-hmm. But it's the time that we've got to sit there and really, okay, we have to make use of that hour phone call. Mm-hmm. Other than taking us each other for granted when we see each other every single day.
It's interesting because one of the things I'll talk about with rituals probably today, we're in the exact opposite situation where we've moved to California 4 miles from my stepmother, and we've never lived near her. We haven't lived, actually, my husband and I are about to have our 40th anniversary on April 1st, and we've never lived around family. So we are figuring out how to be more of a face-to-face family with her or just with any family because we never had it. And so it's good, and it's got its sets of challenges for us, and I'm sure for her as well. So that's part of the idea with family. With communications and relationships are always in flux. They're always changing. We're getting older. People's health is changing. Their geography is changing. I mean, the way they see and hear change. So that, my stepmother is one of the issues that we're negotiating is she doesn't hear very well. And that's just really difficult for us to be sensitive to, if you will. So that it just reminds us why the study of communication is so absolutely critical.
Yeah. And so taken for granted as well in a way, because we're seeing it as, okay, we're talking. We always say we're talking, we're not communicating. There's two completely different things that we're doing. We're talking to each other, but instead there's a whole other way of communicating with each other.
I think we're always communicating, but we're not always communicating effectively. So there may be different ways, and that goes back to having that wider repertoire of being able to figure out what kinds of ways to say and do things for different people at different times, and even to make it better for ourselves as well. And so when I grew up, men were king. My dad was sort of the king of the household. And, just gender roles changed over the years to where the way he would have communicated with us growing up wouldn't be very effective today. He didn't have to really change. He could communicate at the office with his children, with his neighbors, in very similar ways, and it worked. But today we have a much more complicated and diverse world, and so we're around people from other cultures. So we're talking today from I don't know how many miles apart we are. And there's things about our cultures that are very similar and some things that are going to be different. All of that are things that we have to take into account if we're going to be competent communicators. Hmm. It's kind of exciting. It's daunting, but it's also exciting.
No, it is. Like, I'm even thinking about in a family context and especially looking into rituals. And I know we talk about family rituals quite a lot. We've already started talking about it. But what would the actual definition of a family ritual be?
Well, you know, you've asked me what a family ritual is, and much as I did about my definition of family, I'm going to unfortunately give you a little bit of a longer definition, but I'll go back and unpack the pieces for us because rituals are so important and they're so fascinating. So one of the reasons that we that I like to study rituals is they're communication events. They're based on communication. Sometimes we think about them as routines and traditions. This is another word. They're voluntary and they're repeated. So if we only do something once, we really wouldn't think about it as a ritual. And rituals have to be voluntary, participating. Although we may come back to that because that voluntary part is kind of complicated. It takes two or more people. So we do things that are habits. You know, I do individual habits, but we wouldn't call those rituals. One of the things that's really important about family rituals is they honor something that is sacred or special. And we don't use sacred here in a religious way, although it might be, but that it honors something that we consider important to us as a family. And rituals help families create change, and it helps us to establish and change our identity. So again, rituals help us to know who we are in the family and who we are in the world. So that's a lot of things that rituals do for us, but it's important when we think about them as voluntary, as repeated, as at least for family rituals involving two or more people. They may be rituals that involve a subset of the family or a dyad within the family, just two, or they may involve the whole family. That's important to know. And again, that they have this special meaning, this importance, that they honor something that's special and that they help us create and change and to form and change our identity. So rituals really do a lot of work in families when you think about it that way. They're kind of hard work at communication, but they are based in communication.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's always interesting when we're talking about the voluntary part, because I think the voluntary is such a, and I know we're going to talk deeper about that earlier, but it's always such an interesting aspect when we're looking into what each member is set to take part of. Like, for example, if there's a family dinner, there's the kids are the ones setting the table or setting up the decorations or getting the glasses out and getting the dishes out. And the parents are usually the ones that are hanging around the kitchen, cooking, getting the barbecue on, for example, and doing all these things. And that's just, sometimes it's an unwritten tradition. Sometimes it's just something that's set into becoming a habit rather than a ritual. It's just something that you know within that ritual that that's what is the task is, each member is doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things to remember, that rituals have expectations about them. Expectations, for example, of what you would do to get ready. And then they involve roles, right? What your role in this ritual is. And you're right, when you're a little child, they would let you put a fork on the table, but they wouldn't let you carry the really good glassware, right? Some people are expected to cook. Some people, I mean, everybody has a part. And it may be a really central, important part of the ritual, or it may be a more a peripheral and less important part of the ritual. But there are rituals always have expectations, and that's also where communication comes in. You know, how did you learn that you were supposed to set the table? Did somebody tell you? Did somebody show you? Sometimes roles are just come from modeling. You look at what the older children do when you're little and you start doing it. Or your grandma or grandpa may take you aside and say, well, this year you get to carry this or you get to do that. And then it may be that you have elder relatives who are starting to time out. That maybe your grandmother can no longer cook and host the dinner, you know, that you have. And so it's that ritual moves to somebody else's house. Or we start doing takeout food, or, you know, it's always changing. But rituals are centered around communication, and that's how we figure out what to do and what our role is. And the voluntary part is tricky, because sometimes if everybody was forced to come, if we were all handcuffed and let in, you know, it's really hard to think about that as a ritual. And so it doesn't mean that we always are dying to be there. I suppose when kids are teenagers, they kind of, oh gosh, I don't want to go to one more of these stupid, you know, dinners. But there has to be a sense of voluntary, that the family does this because it's important to them. And even if sometimes they may feel a little bit forced, or I don't want to go to church anymore on Christmas Eve, or I don't want to do this or that. And so it goes back to the role of communication is really strong as we figure all of that out.
Mm-hmm. And why is effective communication really important in sort of establishing those family rituals?
Think about it. We communicate to have our rituals. We communicate to communicate our expectations and our roles, and we carry out that. So many of our rituals are around communication. You know, whether we say a prayer or we give each other a compliment or we avoid certain topics. Communication is just central. And remember, we talked about how communications, how we co-create relationships, families, and selves. That's all coming through communication. Rituals are co-created as well. Even when they're handed down to us and we're told about them, we know that that comes from communication. And something else interesting about rituals and communication is that family rituals especially are the way that I always call it knitting together our past and our present and our future. You know, rituals, remember we said families occur over time. Rituals usually occur over time. They change. But that's a way that we bring the past into the present. And we know our family's been using, I was just telling the story, you can see behind me is a hutch. I'm not like this American senator that got put in her kitchen to do a speech the other night. I was laughing when I was in front of my hutch. But I have a set of silverware in that hutch, and I'm adopted. And after I was adopted, my adoptive mother's parents were going to come see us. They lived in another state, and they got on the train, and somehow they got on the wrong train, and they had to go back home, and they were going to come again in a couple of weeks, and my grandfather had a heart attack and died. He never saw me, and I was a baby. I never saw him, but for some reason, they were bringing a gift, I guess, to either my mother or to me. I don't really know the history of it, but it was this beautiful set of silverware, and my mother always had it, and she would bring it out for special dinners. And now I have it. And so that's part of how this ritual of, you know, having a dinner and having sometimes artifacts, you know, those things that we own are part of our rituals too. And that's bringing a past relationship, one that I never even got to experience, and they never got to meet me, but they're still a part of my family and a part of my life. Isn't that interesting? So it's the past and the present and the future. And then who, you know, in the future will get this? Who would I leave it to? And so that's one of the really interesting things about rituals that's really powerful. It's knitting together our past, who we are today, and who we think we're going to be in the future. And we leave things like photographs and videos and a set of silverware or a quilt or this table that I'm sitting at. You can't really see the table, but it matches that hutch. That's all part of family. And so rituals are powerful in that way, too, because they have a temporal quality to them.
Mm-hmm. I definitely feel the same way. There's always the necklace that got given by my grandma's grandparents to her when she turned 18. Mm-hmm. And then when I turned 18, that necklace got handed down to me, and it's going to be expected when I have grandkids, when they turn 18, that's going to be handed down to them. And that's just right. Something that goes on collectively. And it's always, and there's an engraved of like my grandmother's maiden name. Mm. So her family name is always somehow connected to me. Yeah. Even though my last name is from my grandfather, there's still like that connection that I have with her line of the family that's never really lost.
Yeah. And it's powerful. And so this past, present, and future quality of rituals is really special. And it's just how, again, especially for families. But we do it in churches and communities and workplaces. You know, we tell the story of the founder of the university or the founder of the workplace. And so, rituals are part of all of our relationships, but especially family.
So we're looking at family rituals. How can communication really be used to enhance the importance of the rituals?
Well, let me give you, I thought I'd give you an example of a ritual. It came from one of my students, one of my early years of teaching in Nebraska. I was there for 25 years at the university.
And a student told us really a lovely story about Christmas Eve. And I don't know how cross-cultural this one will be, but let's see. Her family would go out when they were little children. Her father would take the children, and you know, it's cold in Nebraska, out on the lawn. It was usually snowing. And they would bring carrots with them for Santa's reindeer, for Santa Claus's reindeer. And he would have the children throw carrots on the roof for the reindeer. And this was just something they did that was special to their family. And she was talking to me about, telling our class about how funny this is to do it now that they're young adults. And they're still going out and throwing carrots on the roof, even though I think most of them don't believe in Santa Claus. And we were talking about, why would you still do this? And it was, you know, this idea of what it brought them together. And now these young people were having partners and, you know, boyfriends and girlfriends and getting married and partnering up and bringing these other people into the family. So communication has an interesting role in rituals. Is rituals do determine who's part of the family. So the family could have left those new partners and spouses in the house and said, well, we just do this, you stay here. But they brought them with them. And so whoever was invited out to throw carrots on the roof, as silly as it sounds, they've crossed a boundary. They're part of the family in the eyes of the family. And then what a lot of these people did was they kind of warned their partner, hey, when you come over on Christmas Eve, I know this sounds ridiculous, but we're going to go out of the snow and we're going to throw carrots on the roof. What? And they would prepare them for the ritual. They would communicate with them what their role was. And it's possible in some families that maybe, look, you just stay and watch and you can laugh and applaud, but we're the ones that throw the carrots. Or, and I can't remember, I think they all got carrots. I think everybody was whipping them up on the roof. But communication has such an important role. And so part of the ritual celebrates being a family. It celebrates, again, that past, bringing that past into the present. I assume that many of them will continue this on into the future, perhaps with their own families. And then communication also tells us what you may communicate. If you're smart, you probably would communicate with the partner and you would explain what's going to go on and who's going to participate and what their role is, what they're expected to do. So communication, again, is absolutely essential in setting the tone for that ritual, figuring out who gets to be included. And it may be in some families that they'd even have to talk that over, right? Okay, this is you're the first person to bring a partner home. What are we going to do now? You know, same thing with gifts. You know, gift-gifting is another part of rituals and sometimes a ritual in and of itself. Who gets gifts? Who's supposed to give gifts? How do you know what monetary value or what size a gift is supposed to be? I'm a stepfamily, but also I study stepfamilies. That's my other big area of research. And that's really complicated. You know, what do we do with these children? Do they all get gifts? Do the stepkids get gifts that the other kids get? So things like this that may seem quite trivial become really important. It's really important to communicate about those things. So communication plays a role in enacting the ritual, in setting the expectations. And sometimes the ritual itself is the communication. So we may recite a certain poem, right? Or we may sing certain songs. Or, you know, in Thanksgiving at our table, we take turns and go around and say what we're thankful for. That the communication in itself is part of the ritual. So that's why I say you just can't really separate the study of communication and the study of family rituals. They're just completely intertwined.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense when you sort of put it in that perspective of how important it is to new members of the family as well. When you've grown up having those rituals, you sort of take it for granted as, okay, this is what to expect. But when you bring it into other people, it's their minds that are also having to understand the importance of the ritual, having to understand where the ritual started, how it became so, how they're involved in the ritual as well. Because there's also that need of a boundary, whether it's the family, because I know that in my family, we like to take yearly photos. Hello. So then when I bring my partner in, I'm going to have to explain to them, okay, we're going to take family photos, and I have to decide whether they want to be a part of it. But also understanding the fact that if my family wants them to be a part of it, or whether they just want it to be us the me and my sister and both my mom and my dad?
Exactly.
Or is it going to be my dad and his partner, or my mom and her partner included in that as well? Because then it becomes a whole idea of extended family in another sense, I guess, as well.
Yeah, this happened to me. And when I tell it, it sounds like I'm saying something bad about my stepfamily. I'm not. So my brother and I were both adopted and from other families. And my adoptive mother died when I was 12, and my father remarried. And she had a daughter. And when I was in college, I was away. I think it was when I was at the University of Minnesota. I came back to California. And my stepmother said, oh, they were going to hire a professional photographer. We're going to have a generations picture taken. My stepsister had had a baby. I forgot to tell that part. And so I thought, oh, it's going to be the women. It'll be my step-grandmother, my stepmother, my stepsister, and her daughter, and me. And when I got home, they kind of looked, you know, and they said, well, it's not you. And I was incredibly hurt. I was embarrassed, I guess, and I was hurt that I wasn't part of it. You know, as the years went on, I realized, and the sad part was they canceled the photographer. They didn't take their generation's picture. And they took just one with a little camera. And as I was older and I started studying these things too, I realized, you know, they really deserved to have that picture. I don't think they were trying to be mean or say that I didn't matter. But you can imagine why I probably did feel left out, because I didn't have anybody to have a picture taken with. My mom was gone. And so, you know what I'm saying? That's where just the communication and making these expectations clear is important. The other thing about rituals I haven't mentioned is, we might talk about it if we talk a little bit about conflict, but it just involves deep emotion. And that's what happened that day. And so I hope that example makes sense. But I think it just shows that how important it is to understand these things and to be sensitive about this and communicate about it. And I think if they had thought about it a little more carefully, they might have anticipated. In other words, me getting caught by surprise is on them a little bit too. But it was also on me. I didn't ask the right questions, I suppose, because I didn't even think to do it. So, you know, I think everybody had great intentions that day, but it did cause, hurt feelings.
Yeah. No, it's a great example, actually, especially on what happens when you don't communicate. And also the fact that maybe there's this compromise in communication that sort of needs to take place as well. Maybe you could do one photo with you, one photo without you, sort of included in that as well. Like there's the whole idea of knowing, okay, this is what the situation is. Is there a way that everything can be communicated where both sides are feeling respected, where both sides, their needs are being wanting to fulfilled? And especially about family, there's like a whole other idea of, and especially the way that my family has sort of extended as to now where my parents are two individual people, the two individual parents. There's still mom and dad, but it's not mom and dad together. There's mom and dad in being their own people with their own partners in the future. And it's an interesting dynamic that we now sort of go to, where I'm really glad that they're still the best of friends, that they've grown into a friendship relationship rather than a romantic relationship. And it hasn't really changed in the way that I also expected when I sort of found out that they are going their separate ways. Because
that doesn't always, I mean, you're really fortunate that they are able to do that, because we have been studying actually positive step families, because they're, you know, we tend to focus on the problems in step families. And so we've been trying to interview people that say they have overall positive step families to see what makes them positive. And so much of it is thinking ahead and trying to anticipate, you know, what would be the best way to, you know, sometimes it's like the picture thing. I just don't think they even gave it a thought. And if I was them, maybe I wouldn't have either. And so that's, again, where communication and being flexible and just trying to think ahead a little bit is wise. And that's so important with our family rituals as well, because they are important to us. Yeah.
Yes. And now, when I hear the term rituals, especially for me, when I was sort of doing a little bit of research into today's topic, I felt really positive about them, because the way that I see it is that its aim is to bring families together. It's an aim to bring everyone closer. But you raised a really great additional point, sort of in the way that it can be seen as a completely contrasting effect and have a way that is creating a lot more conflict. So
yes,
how can they sort of have the potential to create more conflict?
You know, anything that involves identity, anything that's really important to us, anything that involves boundaries, who's in and who's out, and it involves a lot of emotion, it's just sort of ripe for conflict. And so we can have a lot of conflict around our rituals. You know, in the last couple of years that I taught classes in interpersonal communication and family communication, and students got to pick a topic that they would study for the semester, the topic of family conflict around different political beliefs. And those often play out in rituals, right? Around the dinner table, around the holiday table, so that sometimes rituals bring on conflict. And the other thing, and I even hate to raise it, but it's true, rituals are often very positive and joyous, but they can be terrible. I mean, you can have rituals that are physically punishing. You can have rituals that are psychologically and emotionally negative and punishing. So just because they're rituals doesn't mean, I mean, if you want to, again, the thing with the photos, if somebody had really wanted to hurt me that day, and they did it, but that would have been the way to do it, right? To show me that I really don't belong, that I'm not a blood relative. We should always remember that rituals can bring about conflict, sometimes intentionally, often unintentionally. And those are really hard things to work through because they involve deep emotion. So I think it's important for us to realize that all families are not positive, all relationships are not positive, and all rituals are not positive all the time. And even when we have the very best of intentions, we've studied rituals in step families, in fact. And what happens when you become a stepfamily, what happens to all of your original family rituals? And we have a publication called Empty Ritual. And we studied, you know, so often when the parents get married, they're all excited, you know, the parent and the step-parent, and they're in love. And you know, so they do things like they have the kids stand up there and be part of the wedding, and they get special clothes. And often kids find that terrible. I mean, they thought it was cool and they were getting a new dress or a special ring or something. And I remember we've interviewed kids who talked about, yeah, it was all going well. And then I got up there and we were standing at the altar and I was saying, no, no, no. You know, they probably secretly always thought their parents were going to get back together. So sometimes, you know, we don't include people in these rituals. And sometimes even when we try to, those rituals are still not positive for people. And so, you know, step families are one place where this can play out in very positive or powerful ways. Mm-hmm. I guess you're talking about the communication part. I should have answered the second part. I think this sounds oversimplistic, I know. Just try to be smart and think ahead. What's the best thing that could happen if we have this dinner or this ritual or this kind of wedding ceremony or throwing carrots onto the roof, besides that you can come back and impale your eyeball or something. You know, what's the best things that could happen? But, you know, play a little bit of what's the worst that could happen? How might this fail? And how might we work our way around that? Maybe we should talk to everybody, you know, to the kids. Do you really want to be in the wedding? Do you want to stand up there with us? You know, and so much of that's invoking communication as well. So don't just assume it's going to be positive just because it looks positive to you.
Yeah. I feel like especially one of the worst ways is also the fact that with aging families as well, as like kids get older,
yeah,
parents get older, there's the idea of, okay, because it's Christmas, as a kid, you used to spend it with your parents. The minute you get a partner, there's a tie between, do I spend it with my family or do I spend it with my partner's family on the day? And which one's willing to budge? Because I hear a lot, especially amongst my friends, about that exactly that conflict,
yeah,
as, okay, I'm married now. Do I go and spend it with my family and do the traditions that we do? Or do we spend it with our partner's family? Or how do we balance dinner between the both of them?
And then
in
you
a way
think
that's
about
also...
Yes, yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt it.
No,
think
that's
about
fine.
Stepfamilies, like, you know, where now you've got four parents or you might have six parents and you've got a bunch of grandparents. I mean, it's so complicated and difficult to navigate those waters. Exactly. You're exactly right.
And then even if you're married with your spouse, it's like you also want to have your own traditions with them. It's like, how do you manage the both the parents, all the parents, but also have those traditions where you get to really enjoy yourself instead of being completely burnt out, having your family have an argument amongst each other and your partner's family have an argument amongst each other. And then you get home, instead of celebrating together, you're both too exhausted to even look each other in the eye. And there's that idea of like, it's two families now, but it's also a third family of you and your partner and eventually your kids, and having those traditions of, do you want your kids to be with which grandparent, or do you want them to be with you on Christmas? And that's the biggest thing, I think, especially when it comes to big holiday celebrations and big traditions and rituals, because as you get older, if neither of the members are willing to budge, there's always going to be that conflict that sort of takes place. So this leads us really well into the next part of the show, which is the practice and habit. Now, this is something that you do yourself or that you do within your family as well. So what is a practice that you do to enhance the quality of your family rituals when it comes to effective communication within its members?
Well, our family is so interesting because, one, we're really small. And my husband and I had lost all of our parents pretty early in life, except we have a stepmother, my stepmother, who's here in California. And so we've been married almost 40 years, and we have spent all of our 40 years rituals, holiday rituals, et cetera, with just Chuck and me and friends and chosen family. And so we often hosted large dinners when with our colleagues at the university, because so many of us were living in places where our families didn't live. This past year, we've moved, left Lincoln, Nebraska, where the university was, and we've moved back to California, where my husband is from and my stepmother lives. And now we're a family. We're not a family of two anymore. We don't have children. We're a family of three, and we're learning to be a family of three with her. And since my father passed away 19 years ago, she's been living out here on her own. So we're really happy to be here and really happy to be with her. But it's funny. We're kind of negotiating these rituals almost opposite, from going from being two to now being a family of three. And how, for example, we at Christmas. Chuck and I love to cook, and we love to eat too. And she's a person that food just doesn't have a lot of meaning to her. She doesn't eat. She eats mostly vegetarian. She eats different foods than we do. And so it's been really interesting. And we would normally invite other people to come over for Christmas too. And we were really sensitive about that because it was our first Christmas here with her. And we didn't want to sort of cancel out this new family of three that we're forming. And so this practice has been interesting because we've had to think really carefully about and talk to her about it too. And I think we'll still need to talk more. The other ritual that we started is she comes over Sundays and after church and comes over to our house for about 3 hours on Sundays. And we would normally want to feed her. We would want to have a meal, but she doesn't want to do that. And that's fine, you know, it's okay. So we've had to think about, well, we got to make sure we eat before she comes, and you know, and so we're just, it's fascinating. It's a communication exercise in trying to anticipate. Now we've got Easter coming up here, and so you know, she'll come over for Easter, and well, what would she said she would have dinner, so it's like, yay, that's a win. But she doesn't eat any of the foods that we would normally serve. So none of it's a big deal. But it's just, again, that idea of communicating and trying to think ahead to how we want to spend this time together, how we want to still have our own rituals of things that we would enjoy doing, and how we make it comfortable for her as well. So we're right in the middle of just figuring all that out at our advanced ages when you think about it.
No, that's such a really interesting dynamic as well, because you're going from knowing exactly what the both of you like to trying to figure out what it is that she would like, and also maybe her participating or her also having her own traditions that she used to do by herself with her friends, and seeing what she can bring to that, to your dynamic as well. So
And she and my father were kind of, I would call them sort of low ritual. I think there are people that are sort of high and low ritual. There's no scientific concept there. But, you know, I would call them on Christmas, and I'd say to my dad, What are you doing today? And he'd say, as little as possible. That to him, that was almost a successful Christmas, was kind of making it a pretty normal day. And to us, that would be a giant failure. Gosh, because Christmas was like any other day, I think we would have thought we had a bad Christmas. And so neither one of those is necessarily better than the other. But, you know, how do you put those different views of rituals together and make it work? Yes. And that's what we're trying to figure out.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a great start to an adventure,
It's an adventure.
It's using your own communication skills that you've studied for so long as well, which is really interesting.
Yeah, if I can't be aware of this and try to figure it out, I don't know who can, I suppose. but we blow it. Sometimes we just don't think of things.
Yeah.
And we just think, because it's what we do, right? Well, we do this on Easter, or we do this at Christmas, or we do this at whatever. They're not just holidays. Rituals aren't just holidays. Or how we do weddings. You know, you can't, I don't know about the newspapers in your part of the world, but here, you know, there's always these advice columns. And so often the advice that people are writing about are about rituals, about weddings and who gets invited and who gets left behind and who walks a bride down the aisle. And, you know what I mean? All that stuff. It's all about rituals.
That's very
people
true.
Write about that all the time.
Yes. No, that's very true. And I think it's such a great topic to sort of mention and sort of talk about. Now, this ties us in really well with the open mic session of our show. This gets you to talk about anything that you are passionate about or maybe something that you want to promote here in our show. So in the last minute, I'd love to give you the floor and maybe share what's on your mind today.
Well, just one of the other topics that I study that I think is so powerful and tied into all the rest of this is this idea of chosen family. You know, there are just so many people in the world that don't have a close relationship with their blood biolegal family or don't live around them or, maybe for LGBTQ people who feel that their family's judgmental and not accepting. You know, it's so, I think, so beautiful and powerful to see people form families outside of blood and law and create chosen families for themselves. And it's just something I promote, and I promote people thinking about, you know, as holidays come and birthdays come, is looking around and making sure that people aren't left behind. You know, it's so easy to set another place or at least invite somebody. If they don't want to come, they don't want to come. But I'm just very passionate. I think because this was also a big part of my life, I guess, because I rarely lived around our family. And I just think that it's something that can bring so much to our lives and certainly to our rituals. So I just encourage everybody to think about chosen family and not to be afraid to reach out. You know, if you're lonely, if you want to be with people or you don't want to be with people, is letting the people in your life know what you need. So I guess if I get up to my open mic and up on my pulpit a bit, that's what I would say.
Yeah, no, that's such a great advice to sort of share. And I think it's so important to also list out and let people know that they're your chosen family. I think it's just important to communicate to them that they are that figure in your life.
Mm-hmm. Because sometimes people do think about people as family, but they've never told them. I think that's a good point.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, mm-hmm. I think it's important to have that communication, to have that understanding that that's how you see them.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Dawn, for coming onto the show today and for
my
talking
pleasure.
About effective communication. Rituals are such a complex sort of situation, and trying to figure out where you stand in the ritual is just as important as figuring out what the ritual is to start off with. Now, if our listeners want to find out a little bit more about you, is there a place that I can send them over to?
Yeah, you know, I do write a blog for Psychology Today. They have a large blog program here in the U.S., and you can type in Psychology Today and my name, Dawn O'Braithwaite, and I try to write one a month, and sometimes I write blogs with other people, and so we have written about rituals and chosen families and, conflict and love and just all sorts of communication topics. My blog is called Communication Matters, and I mean that in both ways that we think it's important, and we try to write about a lot of the different matters surrounding communication. So Psychology Today, Dawn O'Braithwaite, you'll be able to read, and they're short and very easy to read.
Perfect. Well, I'll definitely have that down in the link below in the description so everyone can easily access it and find out a little bit more about communication and also get in touch with you if there's anything that they're wanting to ask. So thank you again, Dawn, for joining me on the show. It was amazing having you here.
It was great. And thank you for inviting me and being so easy to work with.
Of course. I hope you guys learned as much as I did when it comes to rituals and how to sort of add communication into, and also the importance of adding communication into a ritual. I'll see you all in the next episode.
You've been listening to All Together, the Family Science Insights podcast, produced by the Family Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes are available from 10 life management perspectives and can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and other podcasting apps available on your devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people find it so that we can grow and bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website at fa.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Dina Sargent. Thanks for tuning in.